Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the fact that the United States has already declared economic warfare on Iran and is in the process of crippling their economy and impoverishing their people. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell, who currently teaches at William & Mary and George Washington University, joins us to discuss the lethal nature of what the U.S. is inflicting on Iran short of military action and how it compares to the historical record when the U.S. embargoed Japan prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor, to the point that the Japanese economy was strangled and they had no access to steel, copper, etc., and more importantly, were running out of oil. We will assess the likelihood of this strategy of bringing the Iranians to the negotiating table to cry uncle will work, or is the theocratic regime with its hardline Praetorian Guard of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, which the Trump administration has designated as a terrorist group, likely to strike out in the face of national humiliation? Or, as the Iranian people suffer the brunt of the increasing economic deprivation they are undergoing, are they likely to rise up against their government to bring about the regime change John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are hoping for? Or are they likely not to want to dance to America's tune, since it is America who is punishing them and making their lives more miserable than the mullahs already have? Then we will speak with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 of which as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees, the author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. He joins us to discuss his article at Common Dreams, Iran and the Coalition of the Weird, and his concern that Trump's newfound moderation will likely last as long as it takes for Benjamin Netanyahu or Sheldon Adelson or maybe Mohammed bin Salman to phone the White House. Then finally, we'll speak with author and filmmaker Astra Taylor, whose latest film is What is Democracy?, about her new book just out, Democracy May Not Exist, But We Will Miss It When It's Gone. She has done extensive research on how democracy is both under attack around the world and a promise unfulfilled. Having interviewed average Americans about their understanding of democracy, her findings are alarming, just as the fact that much of the structure of American democracy itself is alarming, given how many presidents recently have been elected with fewer votes than their opponents, a trend that is likely to worsen in the future. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. Am I correct in making these historical analogies? I'm not sure. In fact, I've talked to a bunch of friends, some of whom went to Princeton and other, Ivy League universities, and they weren't aware of what happened with the Japanese prior to Pearl Harbor in terms of the economic embargo the U.S. was imposing on them. And they essentially, as far as I know, the Japanese, they couldn't get oil from, I'm not suggesting the U.S. wasn't right in punishing them from what they were doing in occupying China and Manchuria, et cetera. But at the point that they weren't able to get oil from Brunei and from Indonesia, from the Dutch, they basically, as far as I can tell, had a choice. We either invade and grab that oil, because we're running out, and the Navy would run out of oil, or we attack Pearl Harbor. So walk us through.
There are two historical problems with that sort of assertion, and I know you know this. First of all, the situation in 1936, 1937, up to 1941 was far more complex than just the one issue of the oil embargo. That, however, was a major decision-making point, if you will, in the War Cabinet in Japan. There's no doubt in my mind that the archives support that. But let's just fast forward to today and say that the economic warfare the United States is conducting against countries like Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran is far more stark, dramatically punishing, profoundly onerous than anything the United States did with respect to Japan in the late 30s, early 40s. So this economic warfare that the United States is waging today, largely based on the fact the dollar is the world's transactional and reserve currency, as Charles de Gaulle said, is the most pernicious weapon being wielded by the United States today. And more importantly, it's being wielded with no strategy, no forethought, just in a brutal, brutish manner in order to punish regimes we don't like. It's a very different situation from the late 30s, I think.
Well, I was wanting to focus on the Japanese thinking, which I think is the key. And now fast forward to what is Iran thinking with the U.S. base?
You're absolutely right. Iran is thinking, I talked about this morning on MSNBC. I use the comparison, as rough as it is, as imperfect as it is, of the Game of Thrones. I use that rather than Shakespeare now with my students because my students have never read Shakespeare. But they have watched Game of Thrones, the long-running HBO series, which I know no doubt you're aware of. In the penultimate episode, the female heroine to this point, and to this point is 8 or 9 years of shows, has been Daenerys Targaryen, a very beautiful Queen Elizabeth, if you will, type monarch. And this last show, she was spurned by the male lead in the show in her attempt to get him to love her. And so she turned to him in a moment of dramatic cinema, and she said, "Then it shall be fear." In other words, she was saying, you can choose love or you can choose fear. That's the way the world is looking at the United States today, precisely the way this final episode tonight on HBO is going to depict Daenerys Targaryen probably as the woman to be gotten rid of, the woman that no one wants. Because what we have inflicted on the world, on 2.5 billion people in that world at least, including China, including Russia, including almost all the Middle East except for our friends, the greatest state sponsor of terrorism in the world, Saudi Arabia, is fear. And John Bolton is the leading disciple of that foreign policy, security policy right now, the policy of fear. And we're going to pay dearly for it. We're going to pay enormously for it, as I fear Daenerys, Dany, to those who love her, is going to pay tonight in the last episode of Game of Thrones. She's probably going to be killed.
So I guess it gets down to the question, Colonel Wilkerson, whether you fear the bully or you have contempt for the bully.
Well, you fear him, but you also must arm yourself against him. And that's mm-hmm. what I fear for my own country right now, for this country. The world is moving to balance us. If you've been paying attention to Paris, to Berlin, to London, to other capitals in the world that are supposed to be our friends, you'll note there's been a distinct change in the tone of their voices, in the way they look at us. This started with Dick Cheney and George Bush, no question about it. But Donald Trump has accelerated, made more profound, widened, and deepened this falling apart of allies, if you will, and friends, not just allies, but friends too. And this is happening because of our policies in the world, the economic sanctions, constant war. Look at the people Donald Trump has arrayed for the possible use of the war instrument. Russia, China, Venezuela, Iran, Syria, Cuba. I mean, you could go on. This is an administration that is trying to defy the old international principle of conservation of enemies. Don't ever have any more enemies than you can handle at one time. Well, we've got far more enemies than we can handle at one time. I have every expectation that the president is unaware of most of this. I don't think this man is aware very much at all, other than his own ego. But the problem is that underneath that inattention, people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and others are wreaking havoc. And they're wreaking havoc with your and my dollars, and they're wreaking havoc with our future security, because they're making our future security more deeply in jeopardy every moment that they exist.
And again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. And there's no doubt, Colonel Wilkerson, that lately John Bolton has been pushing the envelope, as has Pompeo, and you get the feeling that the U.S. has at least three foreign policies, and I think it's a lot of it is due to the fact that you sort of have an absentee landlord in the president who's very disengaged and more interested in tweeting about his problems with the Democrats and the Mueller report, etc. But he did seem to wake up and realize how close we came to war. My understanding is that the Iranians were absolutely convinced that the U.S. is about to strike them, and they started to get into a defensive posture, and the overheads picked up the fact that they're putting missiles on these little speedboats, not necessarily to attack us, but to prepare for us attacking them. And then finally, when Trump realizes how close we came to war, he slapped Bolton down. Is that your understanding?
I think there's some truth in that, and that's the strongest story that's running around inside the Beltway today. I think what has happened is Trump is finally confronted with the fact that he has an array of potential uses of military force out there, that his inattention has more or less allowed John Bolton and Rick Scott from Florida and Marco Rubio from Florida and Elliot Abrams and a host of other rather evil creatures lurking around this administration and doing things, since the president is not very attentive of what they're doing, and making a mess with Venezuela, where Gina Haspel last week promised Bolton and Trump that the latest iteration of the U.S. coup in Caracas would be successful, and it wasn't. I would have fired Gina Haspel right on the spot just for that. This is all taking place while Trump, as you just pointed out, is becoming at least vaguely aware of the fact that he's gotten himself into a mess internationally. I've even heard yesterday, I think this was from a fairly reliable source, actually two sources, that Pompeo is so concerned with Bolton getting too far out on his plank that he is letting it be known that he's more with the president than he is with Bolton. Well, that would make sense, because that's what Mike Pompeo is basically, is a sycophant looking for whatever the president wants and giving it to him. So if he senses that the president is not really interested in using force with regard to Iran, then we're going to see a break between Pompeo and Bolton, and that may very well be developing right now. There's even a strong rumor that the president is going irritated enough with Bolton that we might be looking at yet another national security advisor in a week or two or a month. I'd welcome that with open arms, as long as it were a halfway decent person who took his job. Because John is an evil person. Let's just face it, he's an evil person.
Well, I wouldn't count on Trump making a better appointment. It hasn't happened so far.
Who wants to work for him?
But
that's becoming a significant problem.
Yeah.
No one in the national security elite of any consequence, or even someone outside, say a governor or someone who's identified themselves and their bona fides readily in this or that area, none of those people want to work for this guy. Would you?
Well, clearly, this is, instead of it being Abraham Lincoln's cabinet of rivals, it is a team of rivals. This is a team of grifters. This is the most appalling administration in American history.
And he's largely done it himself, intentionally or otherwise, probably both at times. He's gotten rid of all the people who had sufficient weight to push back against him, sufficient sanity to check his insanity. And he's gotten rid of them. He got Patrick Shanahan, a defense contractor, a true sycophant at defense now, got rid of Mattis. Mattis objected too much. You got Bolton instead of McMaster. McMaster objected too much. You've got Pompeo instead of Tillerson. You've got everyone arrayed around Trump now who's willing to say, aye, aye, sir, three bags full, tell me how high to jump, except perhaps for Bolton, who seemed to know how to trick the president, but now is running out of that capacity. So it's going to be interesting to see how Trump deals with his cabinet, as it were, over the next month or so, as he gets more and more deeply into these things like this confrontation with Iran. And then when General McKenzie, the new Central Command commander, spoke up the other day, bellicose, as if he wanted war tomorrow morning, that probably scared the bejesus out of Trump.
Well, it is frightening, and I think the American people are a little bit asleep at the switch here, not recognizing the nature of economic warfare and how it is crippling the Iranians and limiting their options in spite of the fact that Zarif says that there will be no war. I don't know that you can count on that.
Let me tell you how bad it is. There's a gentleman, a billionaire, in Salt Lake City, who has been trying to get a ship with humanitarian supplies through to the flood victims of Iran. And OFAC, wanting the Office of Financial Assets, Foreign Assets Control, will not even let this ship sail. Now, in 2003, when the earthquake hit BAM and killed thousands in Iran, I went to Secretary Powell and I said, Mr. Secretary, we have got to get. And he looked at me and smiled, and he said, LW, I know what you're going to say. You don't need to say it. George Bush has already authorized it. And he had. We sent firemen. We sent search dogs. We sent search teams. We sent ambulances. We sent all manner of food, water, and other humanitarian supplies for those thousands of earthquake victims. And we left them there for months on end until Iran had recovered from that. Now we're looking at 70% of Iran's annual rainfall having fallen within 13 days. There are some 1,300 communities and villages and towns that are flooded. And this administration is so brutish, John Bolton is so intent on punishing the administration at Tehran that he won't let a single ship go over there with humanitarian supplies on it. This is terrible.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Colonel Wilkerson, my understanding is that Treasury Department's red notice is arguably a more potent a weapon than our nuclear arsenal. But my sense is that if you use this arsenal and cut off the access to SWIFT, etc., if you use it too much and too recklessly, at the end of the day, the rest of the world's going to say, well, America's greatest advantage is the dollar, U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency. Let's move away from the dollar. So how much are these people endangering that advantage?
You're right.
Advantage?
You're absolutely right. We are creating a world out there that is going to move to balance us, and one of the first things they're going to do is do it financially. You're going to get a consortium between, say, the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, the Brazilians, maybe some others in there, maybe the Pakistanis in there. And you're going to say, okay, let's use the renminbi. Let's build an alternative to SWIFT. Let's do this, let's do that. Now, that counterargument to that economists will throw at you is that, look, the United States, as bad as we are at this moment, is still the ultimate safe haven for people's monies. So they are going to continue to buy our treasury notes. They will not stop. They will hold their nose and buy our treasury notes. And what I say back to the economists is, you don't understand the way the world is beginning to look at us. In polls now, 2.5 billion people in the world say that the number one threat to their families, their children's future is the United States of America. The polls in Korea even are over 50% think the United States is the number one threat to their future. This is South Korea, our signatory treaty ally. In Pakistan, it's not India that they see as the greatest threat to the future. It's the United States of America. In Egypt, it's all over the world now. People think we are crazy. And when that happens, just look back at history. When that happens, when an empire becomes so arrogant and so imperial that it is hurting the majority of the world the majority of the time, people move to get rid of it.
Well, just in closing, what would your betting be on whether the Iranians can continue to restrain the IRGC, which the U.S. has designated as a terrorist organization, and the Iranians in turn are designated CENTCOM as a terrorist organization, which puts our troops in Iraq in jeopardy. There are 5,000 there who are very vulnerable. You've got people like Mohammed bin Salman and MBZ in the Emirates and Netanyahu, all of whom would, as former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, they'd like to fight Iran to the last American. You've also got Betsy DeVos's brother with his mercenary army there in the Emirates, Eric Prince, poised to cause trouble. So given that lethal mix, do you think we're going to get by without a war in the Gulf?
I think it's going to depend ultimately on accident. And that's a terrible thing to have to depend on. That is to say, is there a significant incident in the Gulf that turns into a Tonkin Gulf and makes it inevitable that we have to use force? Or Donald Trump's ability to manage this crisis and to keep us from doing it, ultimately making the decision not to do it. But you just named the three culprits in this: Netanyahu, MBS, and MBZ. They want a war, or at least a significant bombing of Iran to sort of show it who's the real boss and to put the Sunnis back in the driver's seat in the Gulf. Those are incredible forces and incredible pressures for a very inexperienced and largely incompetent president to have to deal with. I wouldn't want to be in his shoes. He's got himself in a real mess. Not only that, North Korea is looking increasingly like it's falling apart. China has just announced, it will say, no doubt because of the trade war Trump has started with China, it is going to say, to hell with your sanctions, we are buying Iranian oil. Pakistan has announced it will follow suit. India will probably follow suit. The sanctions will begin to unravel. Iran will be sitting there looking like still in the catbird seat, strategically in the Persian Gulf, and Donald Trump will have egg all over his United States of America face. I mean, this is a real mess. But as you said, we could have a war in here at any time that'll make it even more of a mess.
Well, Colonel Alonzo Wilkerson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who's the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. And currently, he teaches courses at the College of William and Mary. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about Iran and the Coalition of the Weird. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And he has an article at Common Dreams, Iran and the Coalition of the Weird. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
It's nice to be here.
So, Mike, we just were speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff of Secretary of State Colin Powell, and he painted a pretty bleak picture of what's going on in the Gulf, that we already have declared economic warfare on Iran, and, of course, we did that on Japan, and that led to Pearl Harbor. So we're trying to figure out what's going on in the mind of the Iranians. But at the end of the day, his analysis was that either one of two things will happen. Either we'll have a war that will be triggered by the mendacity of MBZ, MBS, and Netanyahu, and also the mercenary army of Betsy DeVos's brother, Eric Prince, which is there in the Emirates. His specific function would be to trigger a incident. That's one scenario. The other scenario is that the rest of the world is just fed up with Trump and his America First bullying, and the Chinese are going to decide to screw you guys. We're going to start buying Iranian oil, and everybody else is going to start buying Iranian oil, and Trump is going to end up, and America's going to end up with egg on its face. What's your prediction?
Well, things never tend to proceed in real life in a very sharp, binary way. You know, there's other possibilities, and one of them simply is, I haven't seen any polling data, but I think the popularity of a war, you know, however much they ginned it up in 2002 before the Iraq invasion, it's just not there. And it's certainly not there among Trump's base. And he seems, and I never thought I would say this, he is the restraining influence on people like John Bolton. And I have no confidence in his ethics or morality, but I do have confidence in his sort of feral sense of self-preservation, that he knows this is what the base wants, and he's going to pander to them. And what the base wants is a stop to some of these interventions. We'll see all kind. I mean, no government is a monolith. You're going to see people like Bolton and Pompeo popping off and saying all kinds of stupid things and raising the temperature. But at least it's conceivable that Trump, just as in North Korea, the fire and fury stuff didn't lead to anything. And we all know how his overthrow of Maduro in Venezuela went. Because there's also a very cogent reason, which is, any incumbent president takes the credit or the blame for the economy. We can argue about the economy, about how good it is, income inequality, lack of benefits. But by conventional measures, it's good. And he gets the credit. That could turn around really fast if the Straits of Hormuz get closed. And somewhere in his mind, that has to be considered.
But Mike Lofgren, in your article at Common Dreams, Iran and the Coalition of the Weird, you say that Trump's newfound moderation will likely last as long as it takes for Benjamin Netanyahu or Sheldon Adelson or maybe Mohammed bin Salman to phone the White House.
Well, that's the countervailing force, which is these people who have so much influence on him can egg him on into this, and he will not listen to, and I hate to say the phrase, the angels of his better nature, because that's what Sheldon Adelson wanted, a nuclear strike on Iran. That's public knowledge. Netanyahu has been behind for the last 15 or 20 years effort to try to goad the United States into intervention in the Middle East. And we saw with Mohammed bin Salman how Trump sort of genuflected to him over the Khashoggi incident, where an American resident was murdered.
Well,
so it's really a jump ball at this point.
Right. Well, that's pretty much what Colonel Wilkerson told us, and it's and the long-term trends of America under Trump being the global bully is going to backfire, and then eventually, using economic warfare as we do, the rest of the world's going to stop using the dollar as the as a reserve currency and get their own SWIFT system.
That is the way it's trending, and economic warfare really has never worked in Cuba or Venezuela or North Korea. We've had sanctions on North Korea since about 1951. So that's not really a likely scenario that they will simply capitulate on our terms.
No, but they are likely to fall apart, though. Colonel Wilkinson brought it up. It's not being well reported. But the situation in North Korea is absolutely dire. The people are starving. Its place is falling apart because of and this horrible dictatorship is crumbling. And they got nuclear weapons. It's a very, very touchy situation. But let's focus a little bit on your article. At Common Dreams, Mike Lofgren, Iran and the Coalition of the Weird. What do you mean by the Coalition of the Weird?
Well, this is something the mainstream media, I don't know whether because they just don't see it or there's a kind of informal prohibition against talking about it, but the Republican coalition consists of some very volatile and contradictory elements. You have the AIPAC types of Jewish Americans who are very strong Zionists. You have a larger group. They're not as well connected, but they vote, which is the Christian Zionists who believe in Armageddon and building the Third Temple in Jerusalem. And they're all for conflict in the Middle East because it will bring on the rapture. At the same time, you have these groups that Trump is very reluctant to criticize. The guys in the polo shirts with tiki torches who are definitely anti-Semitic, and we know what they think about a conflict in the Middle East, and we know who they're going to scapegoat. And this is a very volatile situation, quite apart from the average Trump voter who doesn't have a dog in the fight in the Middle East, but he thinks that dirt cheap gas is his God-given right, and if the closure of the Straits of Hormuz results in $10 a gallon gas, he's going to be angry. And we've had a volatile situation in this country for several years now, and it's getting very violent with domestic terrorism, and I sort of hesitate to sketch out what could happen when people's dreams of making America great turn to ashes.
Well, that is the problem, and Trump has even hinted that he may unleash these his base, who are heavily armed, on a couple of occasions. He said it publicly, and you know, it's beyond being irresponsible. But you don't think it's going to be the base will be just in the last minute. The base is not going to be released to, for example, if he refuses to leave office, as Nancy Pelosi is concerned, and Michael Cohen said that he thought that Trump wouldn't leave office.
I make no prediction one way or the other. You right. simply cannot tell what's going to happen, but it's worth thinking about.
Right, but in the short term, even though Trump is trying to restrain Bolton, your concern is that an accident could happen, the Straits of Hormuz be closed, Trump's people will be up in arms at 10. Actually, it'd be more like $20.
Yeah, I'm not projecting disaster, right. but I'm saying it is a non-negligible possibility.
Right. And I remember when under Carter, when there was an oil embargo and people had to get their gas on on odd or even days, and that people were having meltdowns then. I mean, we are so pathetically addicted to oil.
It could turn on a dime. All the people who just love Trump could get extremely violent not necessarily on his behalf either.
Mm-hmm. And not necessarily against him.
Because their whole dream world fell apart.
Right. Well, Mike Lofgren, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Appreciated the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government. And he has an article at Common Dreams, Iran and the Coalition of the Weird. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with Astra Taylor about her new book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Astra Taylor, the author of The People's Platform, which was the winner of the American Book Award. She has made two documentaries, Zizek and Examined Life, and her writing has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, N+1, and The Baffler, where she's a contributing editor. And her latest book just out is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Astra Taylor.
Thanks for having me.
So, Astra, already democracy is under threat. It's extraordinary to think that the UK has been paralyzed by Brexit, which was engineered by a Russian prostitute who married a British insurance magnate, allegedly a magnate, and the Russians funneled £9 million for the FSB, the Russian Intelligence Service, and that £9 million was the biggest donation to Brexit, and ever since Brexit, the UK has been paralyzed. Steve Bannon is working zealously to get all these right-wing parties in Europe to vote in sufficient number that they'll get a one-third vote in the European Parliament, which will paralyze the EU. Australia just voted for a right-wing candidate who was a kind of clone of Vice President Mike Pence. He won largely because the media in Australia is controlled by Rupert Murdoch. So in Australia, you have the equivalent of ABC, CBS, and NBC all being Fox News. So this is a sketch of where the world appears to be going. And many of these trends indicate an anti-democratic, illiberal trend, if you will, to quote Orban, the leader of Hungary's use of the word illiberal. So is this the direction that frail democracies are heading in?
Well, you know, there's an old story of democracy. So actually the book is, as you mentioned, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. And it actually emerged out of making a third documentary film called What Is Democracy? That is now available for people who want to watch it. It's streaming on iTunes and Amazon and on Canopy. And in both the film and the book, I go back to Plato, who, you know, is writing and the sort of period of decline of Athenian democracy, so 2,500 years ago. And his book, The Republic, is the sort of foundational text of Western political philosophy. And, you know, in that book, he famously warns that democracy devolves into tyranny because of the rise of a demagogue. And the demagogue is someone who speaks to the people and, you know, promises to make everything right. And so it's sort of this parable that seems very eerily prescient, you know, about the rise of these sort of pseudo-populist figures like Orban, like Trump, you know, and the kind of movement that the Bannons of the world are trying to engineer. But what interests me about Plato's parable, and I think we really have to keep it in mind when we're telling ourselves the story of why this is all happening to us, is Plato is very clear that the context for the rise of this demagogue is a condition of extreme inequality that's allowing the demagogue to emerge. And so, you know, for me, when I'm asking, how did we get here? Why doesn't democracy exist? I think we have to put inequality at the center. And we see, you know, it's certainly something that came up in debates about Brexit. We're talking about it here in the United States. Extreme inequality is antithetical to democracy, because when you have concentrated wealth, you've concentrated power, and that undermines the basic democratic principle of, you know, everyone participating politically as equals.
But how do you explain, Astra Taylor, the fact that the poor people, or the people who the system is disadvantaging in terms of inequality, why do they vote for these demagogues like Trump or like Brexit and in the European Parliament for Le Pen and Orban and all of these people? It's not, there's not that many rich people in the world, so they don't have a lot of votes. So how do they get poor people to vote for them?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a central problem. I think, you know, part of the political situation, political systems, you know, have been designed to sort of give people without means limited opportunities to exercise power. So, you know, people had to fight first for access to the ballot and have to get organized in structure so they can actually, you know, push their representatives. I mean, I think it's a complicated question. Why do people vote against their own interests? And, you know, I don't have, you know, my goal isn't to answer that question, but rather to show the fact that, you know, the book is a work of history and a book of philosophy, right? It's sort of bring political philosophy back into this conversation. You know, and so what it looks at is of democratization. So it doesn't try to answer, okay, what is it that the people right now want? Why aren't they doing the right thing? But rather, how has this idea of democracy evolved over time? How has it become responsive to more people through struggle? And so, you know, I think a central question of political philosophy is sort of, you know, it's a way of addressing what you're asking, but sort of putting it into a philosophical register. It's how do you make, it's Rousseau's paradox. How do you make a democratic people undemocratic people, right? Right now, there's lots of evidence that, you know, quite a substantial number of people, you know, they want a strong leader. And in fact, studies show that centrists, political centrists, are sort of the most hostile to democratic forms of government. There's a very interesting piece in the New York Times about research on this topic, and sort of, you know, centrists are like, no, we'd rather just have someone who can run. They don't really care if there are civil rights or elections, as long as things just work. So, you know, you have to foster a kind of democratic ethos. So, you know, going back to the philosopher Rousseau, he posed this famous conundrum called Rousseau's paradox. That's exactly what I said. How do you create a democratic people out of an undemocratic people? And it's something that there's not sort of one final way to do it, you know, like you just have the perfect constitution and then voila, everybody's, you know, gets along. But it's something we have to do through struggle, through organizing, through building community, through trying to remake our political system so it is more accountable and equitable. And, you know, I think a lot of people are, you know, they're frustrated with the status quo and voted in some situations, you know, genuinely want a more authoritarian society. But in other situations, we're kind of, you know, engaging in a sort of self-destructive protest vote, right? Because they didn't feel there was a better option. And so I think we have to be willing to see people as changeable, and to that's part of politics, is, you know, building conditions so that people can change their minds and join other coalitions.
And again, I'm speaking with Astra Taylor, who's the winner of The People's Platform, which was the winner of the American Book Award. She has made three documentary films, Zizek and The Examined Life and What is Democracy? And her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, N+1, and The Baffler, where she's a contributing editor. And her latest book is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. So the book makes it clear that democracy is a promise unfulfilled. And one of the most stark examples of an unfulfilled democracy, if you will, is the fact that a lot of people don't vote. And in the United States, that's particularly a problem. In countries like Australia, for example, and Brazil, they have compulsory voting. Like, you know, you get the equivalent of a parking ticket if you don't vote. And you do get about 90% plus participation. What is it about democracy that people don't feel the need to participate? And it is kind of extraordinary that when we talked about inequality being a driver, going back to Plato's warning of the destruction of democracy, another phenomenon would indicate that when people are satisfied, the economy is going well, they don't really feel like they need to vote. Does that paradox come up in all the work you've done? Because you've gone around making your documentary, talking to people, you know, regular folk, about their attitudes toward democracy.
What? Yeah, I'll tell you a story of some people I interviewed on the street in Miami, Florida, so at Miami Beach, which is not really the place you think of when you think about democracy, right? So people sort of enjoying their afternoon, and I interviewed a series of random strangers on this park bench, and the scene is in the film. And I asked them some basic questions, like, do you live in a democracy? And some people said yes, and some people said no. And I asked them, do they trust the government? I asked if they vote. And, you know, some people said, yeah, of course I vote. And quite a few said no. And, you know, this can be really alarming, right? Because it's the sort of fundamental right. It's a right people fought and died for not very long ago. And yet people aren't doing it. And I think you're exactly right. There are people who aren't doing it out of, a sense of cynicism and dispossession. And then there are people who aren't doing it out of a kind of complacency. But when I dug in, especially with these two younger men, it was very interesting because at first they were quite glib, like, no, we don't vote. Of course not. And then when I questioned them further, what was revealed was that the election of 2000, and they must have been, you know, little kids, like 9 or 10 years old, maybe a bit older, but the election of 2000 was very formative for them. And they remembered the hanging chads of the, Gore Bush era, right? Cause they're from Florida. And, you know, the votes that ultimately mattered in that election that sort of mattered the most were the votes of, you know, a handful of justices on the Supreme Court. And so what I took from that exchange was that, you know, people, it's not that people aren't voting just out of total ignorance. They have cynicism. They have, a sense that their voices don't matter that's rooted in reality. And so when I try to engage people and make the case for voting, I try to take that context into account, right? You know, yes, your vote is undermined in lots of ways. It's much harder to vote than it should be. So for example, this one young man was just like, why do we even have to register to vote? It's 2016, which is the year I interviewed him. You know, why isn't this automatic? And he's got a good point. You know, there are ways in which our electoral system is, you know, just sort of ridiculously inefficient and inconvenient. And yet my point is those difficulties are exactly the reason we need to be participating, right? The idea of one person, one vote, which is this slogan or this, you know, idea that we toss around, it actually is very recent. It came about in the 60s, in a series of Supreme Court decisions. You know, it's a new idea, the idea that one person, one vote, that we should have this kind of political equality. And, you know, and we still have to fight to make it real. But I think we shouldn't shame people for not participating. We should try to understand why it is that they feel it's not worth their time and their energy and convince them otherwise.
Well, another paradox, it seems to me, Astra Taylor, is that we are in the process of the 2020 elections already started with 22 Democratic candidates running against Trump, and enormous amount of media coverage has already begun, and that will intensify, and billions will be spent, and if they're not being spent already. And everybody, all the pundits sort of talk about it with, you know, granular detail of the process itself. So we sort of celebrate democracy, basically become obsessed with the process, but don't recognize how going back to our Constitution, how in many ways there are some structural problems with our democracy, to say the least. And it was never intended for everybody. It was originally intended only for white men of property. And it's taken a while to get women and African Americans to vote, etc. And so what explains that? Why do we celebrate it, and why does the media make an obsession out of the mechanics of democracy, but very rarely do we really talk about some of the blatantly undemocratic facts that, for example, the last president was elected with fewer votes than his opponent?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There is this sanctimony around the idea of democracy and elections, and that sanctimony covers up how in how sort of anti-democratic our political system is. So exactly right. The Electoral College ultimately is what tipped the balance in favor of Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton had over 3 million more votes. And so what that shows is that, you know, we're very far from the idea of one person, one vote. There's the way the Senate is structured. You know, each state has two senators, and therefore you can have a state that has a very small population in comparison to a populous state like California where you are. And so therefore, you know, if you're casting your vote for Senate in California, your vote weighs much less than someone in Wyoming, for example. And so these are sort of structural conditions. They're the sort of political foundation that we've been building upon. And it's, you know, it hardly qualifies as democratic, even in the sort of limited conception of connecting democracy to voting. And you know, the reform of even directly electing senators, that was a progressive era reform that's, you know, about 100 years old. So, you know, things have democratized and changed. We're not totally stuck with the system the founding fathers engineered, but it's close. And I think you're right. The media does focus on these sort of mechanics, this granular detail. And so what I'm trying to do in my book and in the film is to zoom out and take a larger view, a more philosophical view. And, you know, one question that I pose is, you know, well, why do we think elections are even the apex of democracy? You know, for Aristotle, for example, who wasn't a Democrat, just like Plato wasn't a Democrat, but Aristotle was very, very clear that elections were aristocratic. And, you know, the ancient Greeks would agree with this. Elections were aristocratic because the well-spoken and the well-born and the rich tended to win them. So, you know, ancient Athens was run by sortition or by selection, a sort of random selection of citizens. So every male citizen had a chance essentially of serving in Congress in his lifetime. And so it's, you know, an interesting thought experiment, this obsession with elections. What elections also do to our minds, I think, is they limit democracy to this very prescribed political sphere. So we participate every 2 or 4 years. Instead of thinking about how democracy could spread and in fact needs to spread to other areas of our lives in order to enhance that political equality. In other words, if we had more democratic workplaces, for example, and a more equitable division of labor and prosperity, there'd be a sort of equalizing of economic power that would create the conditions for political equality as well. So I also try in the book to sort of weave together not just, you know, the political sphere in this limited sense, but in a much broader sense of, you know, all of the institutions and arrangements that shape our lives.
Well, of course, in 5th century BC in Athens, which is where we think democracy was born, and I suppose to some extent it was, so I'm not arguing that. But
yeah, the word, they gave us the word.
They gave us the word, but the point to remember is that the vast, I don't know what the percentage of the population was that was disenfranchised, were the helots, the slaves. So not entirely different from what happened here in the South in this country and through the Jim Crow era.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You know, these democratic experiments have been founded on exclusions, on very, you know, harsh exclusions, as you mentioned, exclusions of enslaved people, women, you know, now it's on the basis of people who don't, you know, not having papers, being born on the wrong side of the Rio Grande or the Mediterranean. So, you know, democracy is always having to grapple with these exclusions because, at the heart of democracy is this question of, well, who is the people? Who is the demos that does the ruling? And so this is something, this is another paradox, to go back to paradoxes, is that these movements that we have been praising through this interview, the movements, the social movements that advanced the cause of civil rights and allowed for the conditions under which the Voting Rights Act could be passed so Black people could finally be enfranchised, or the movement to give the vote to women. These were movements actually led by people who were formerly excluded, who weren't even, didn't have the sort of rights of citizenship. So democracy excludes, and yet it's also advanced by those very excluded populations, people on the outside pushing for democracy to live up to its promise and fulfill its potential finally.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, given the work that you've done in your documentary and the interviewing just people on the street, if you will, about democracy, the trends, as we started out in our conversation, don't look good at all around the world. And for example, in the recent elections in Israel, where Netanyahu was reelected, the young people voted hard right. And in Australia, the young people also voted hard right for this character that's a kind of clone of Mike Pence and is a total puppet of Rupert Murdoch's. So those are disturbing trends. I get the feeling, though, in the United States, the reverse is happening. I think the young people in this country are becoming much more politically literate and much more moving to the left, if you will, whereas in other countries in Europe and Australia and Israel, for example, the young are moving to the right. The scene in your movie about the round table of a group of young Miami school children is very interesting in the sense that they don't seem to be that engaged in the broader issues of democracy, but then when they start talking about things that affect them directly, they get very passionate. So walk us through that, if you will.
Yeah, there's a scene in the film that is, it's me interviewing two round tables of inner city school kids who are probably between the ages of 12 and 14, boys and girls together. And I wanted to include that scene because sometimes when we talk about the problems of democracy, we resort to the solution of education. And for good reason. So, education will solve some of our democratic ills. We'll have more educated citizenry, better voting outcomes, et cetera. What these kids, essentially taught me in that encounter is that they are not being taught about democracy. In fact, they're getting a sort of very anti-democratic lesson, because when they try to stand up for their rights, they're basically told, to be quiet, and they're punished quite egregiously. So, one little kid says that they just want their lunch to be warm. That's the extent of their demand. At the same time, they're very astute. They understand that it's not just their teachers being mean to them, that their teachers are embedded in the county's embedded in the state's embedded in the nation. And they're not resorting to blaming some other more vulnerable population for their problems, right? They're looking at the structures of power. And this is a scene that gives me a lot of hope, because you see a sort of democratic potential in them. They're quite generous to each other. And you see, the potential that could be nurtured among the emerging generation if we were just giving them the sort of space and resources to exercise their full potential. And so that, what I did, though, in that scene, I didn't begin with an abstract conversation. Of course they're too young to vote, but, will you vote when you're 18? Or, who do you like what's your favorite candidate for president? When I talked to them about democracy, I didn't ask them about government, which is what they encounter in the classroom. I said, who runs the school? How does it affect your daily life? And I think this is the kind of work we have to do if we want to build a more democratic society, is tie the bigger social problems to people's lived experience, show the connections, show that these conversations matter, and help, and then cultivate a bigger conversation about what democracy is and could be, and to, include in that conversation unexpected people, to not just go to the sort of traditional experts, but go to kids who are still in middle school and high school, because as we see right now, they're at the forefront of a lot of great campaigns for climate change, for gun control, and we need to cheer them on, but also be in solidarity and keep pushing despite all of the worrying trends.
And again, I'm speaking with Astra Taylor, the author and filmmaker of the new documentary, What is Democracy? And her latest book just out is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. So, Astra, there was a very prescient remark made by the retired Supreme Court Justice David Souter, who was on a PBS program up in New Hampshire, and he retired from the Supreme Court, as you know. And this was a few years back, and he predicted Donald Trump. He said that because of the fact that we don't teach civics anymore in school, and this ties into what you were saying earlier about these young kids in your film in Miami, they didn't know much about democracy, but when it came back to their issues of their school, that school doesn't encourage civics. That is what Souter was saying, but he's saying that as a result of this civic illiteracy, one of these days the American people are going to vote for somebody who promises that he alone can fix things, and which is exactly what Trump said in his inauguration speech. So it was a pretty amazing piece of prescience on the part of Justice Souter, but of course deeply depressing. Do you think that that would be a useful step to somehow just reverse this and start teaching kids civics and the basics, principles of democracy that your book and your film are advocating?
I think it would be a wonderful step forward, right? And I think we also have to ask, you know, what does it mean to teach civic literacy? Because it can't just be about the rules of the game, how these political structures work, you know, how votes are apportioned, how districts are drawn. All of that really matters. I'm not denigrating that at all. But I think it's something that has to be brought into people's lives as well. So democracy is a very paradoxical beast. These paradoxes are the sort of guiding principle of my book, my exploration of the topic. But one paradox is that it's both, you know, theory and practice. It's an ideal and a messy reality. And so I would like to see a kind of civic literacy that also allows for democratic practice and engagement in the classroom. And I'd like to see that extended into the workplace, right? I think part of why Americans don't know very much about democracy, right? And why, when I went up to strangers with a camera and said, what is democracy? Why so many of them were actually befuddled and couldn't give me a good answer is because it's not something that we do very much in our daily lives.
And again, the paradox is that we celebrate democracy, but we don't practice it. And one of the things that's extraordinary about our democracy is how the Democrats have to get 8% more votes to break even. And that, as you point out in your book, a scant 2% of Americans residing in the 9 smaller states hold the same power in the Senate as the 51% who reside in the 9 largest states. And some votes literally weigh up to 66 times more than others. And, of course, the trend is that, by the year 2050, 70 red states will have Republican senators and only 30 blue states, heavily populated, will have Democratic senators. So if you control the Senate, you control the courts. And we're already seeing how Trump and McConnell and the Federalists are stacking the courts as we speak. So imagine what it's going to be like with a totally Republican-controlled Senate into the future. It may sound alarming to people, but these are facts.
Yeah, and these are massive trends, I agree. And this is why I think we have to balance our concern about the people and the people having unruly passions and voting in ways that are alarming. We have to balance that sort of traditional, what de Tocqueville called the tyranny of the majority, right? We have to balance that with a real concern about what is turning out to be a tyranny of the minority, because all of these games around gerrymandering, redistricting states so that, you know, Democrats might get a majority of votes by quite a large margin and still hold a smaller number of seats comparatively. These are the machinations through which a minority, you know, holds on to power and contradicts democratic will. And this is how these are going to be, you know, very important issues moving forward, because demographics is not destiny in democracy, because we don't have a situation where the one person, one vote motto is made real. So And I think liberals can sometimes they get excited about demographic trends and you know that somehow naturally you know the Democratic Party will win because it will have majorities. But that doesn't matter if the political system is structured in such a way that the Republican minority actually is able to hold all the power through the Senate, through redistricting, through the Supreme Court, et cetera. So these realities really matter. And, you know, you're right that you can't be too alarmist about it.
And again, I'm speaking with Astra Taylor, the author and filmmaker. Her latest documentary is What is Democracy? And her latest book just out is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. So given that we are in a tyranny of the minority at the moment, we have a president whose popularity sort of oscillates between 30% and 40%. And a majority of people in this country really are unhappy with him. But he may get reelected, which is pretty extraordinary. He may get reelected with an even bigger deficit in the popular vote. But that certainly doesn't bother Trump. But why doesn't it bother the Republicans? Do you think it's possible that you can shame Republicans into accepting that they are profiting from undemocratic structures and change those structures? I know it must sound incredibly naive, but how do you fix this imbalance with the Electoral College and the demographics? Because people are leaving the red states, moving into the blue states, and the more they concentrate the populations in, say, New York and California, the more their votes are diluted.
Yes, I know. And in that sense, you and I are part of the problem, speaking from Brooklyn and Los Angeles. No, it's a tricky issue. It's a collective action problem, right? There has to be a lot of work done on a lot of fronts. But I will say that, okay, yes, you know, this is why voting is absolutely imperative, because, you know, a huge swath of the population doesn't vote. Many of them, people who lean Democratic, so, you know, party officials need to do everything they can to mobilize those constituencies. I think the interesting, you know, your interesting question is one about shame, and I don't think that shame will work, and for two reasons. I think, you know, power responds to power. You know, power concedes nothing without a demand. So I think we need to get organized in order to combat these forces. But I also think there's a long tradition on the right of anti-democratic sentiment. And so there's a sense in which, you know, the conservative movement is returning to its roots. I think that the 20th century, the sort of Cold War era, you know, especially sort of after the collapse of the Soviet Union, was this sort of exceptional moment where there's this sort of idea that capitalism and democracy went together, and a liberal democracy was winning. And so there was a kind of there was in opposition to the threat of communism, then, you know, everybody wrapped themselves in the mantle of democracy. What I found when I was talking to young conservatives, and I'm talking about millennial Republicans, was that they didn't wrap their political ideas in the rhetoric of democracy at all. They were very proudly anti-democratic. They told me democracy was a buzzword. And they were very happy about the Electoral College and the inequities of the Senate and so on. And they, you know, they told me what they cared about wasn't democracy. It was the American dream and the ability to climb. And so I think this is why I don't think shaming will work, because we can't say you're not being democratic if they've already said we don't care about that as a value, right? What we care about is being able to be prosperous, even if other people have to suffer. So I think we have to also sort of know who the opposition is and what ideas are motivating them, so that we can figure out the best tactics.
And again, I'm speaking with Astra Taylor, author and filmmaker, whose latest film is What is Democracy? Her latest book just out is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. So just in the last few minutes, Astra, obviously, money has made a massive difference to our politics, particularly the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. And prior to that, of course, you had Bhakti V. Vallejo that equated money with speech. And for some reason or other, the conservative justices feel that that's written in stone now. But what the consequences of it have been, that our representatives have been turned into telemarketers. Our congresspeople and senators spend most of their days dialing for dollars. And we have, and essentially what happens is they raise millions and millions of dollars, and then they turn that money over to the media monopolies to buy ads, particularly in swing states. And that is our system. So how much, and I know, again, it may be a tilting at windmills to try and get money out of politics, but in the overall work that you've done on examining democracy at its roots and in all of its aspects, how important do you think money is or has become?
I think money is absolutely fundamental to the problem that we're talking about. Money corrupts the political system, and extreme concentration of wealth creates extreme concentrations of power, which, you know, is anathema to democracy, where you need to have a community of people who are, you know, roughly equal. So I think the money thing is extremely important. One of the tragedies of the Trump election, and there are many, is that part of his appeal, and I encountered this over and over and over again as I interviewed people, as I was making my documentary and researching my book, is that one thing people would always say is that they liked that he was so rich that he could theoretically bypass the corruption of money in politics, right? Now, of course, you know, in my opinion, he's just a corrupt plutocrat, you know, friends with these oligarchs around the world. But that was something that really appealed to people. So I think this is one thing, you know, people on the left are certainly worried about money in politics and would like to see publicly funded elections. But there was this sort of core of this core concern among people on the right. I just thought that their solution was incredibly perverse, right? Money corrupts politics, therefore we elect a corrupt billionaire. And I think that, again, it's a matter of organization. I think the right has been very smart to weaponize the First Amendment and to equate money with speech. And, you know, I think that they're also doing it in very alarming ways. For example, the Janus decision, which actually said that, you know, compulsory union dues was a suppression of speech. In other words, using the First Amendment to suppress labor unions. And you know, that points to one of the solutions. The solutions is to, you know, join a union if you can, join all sorts of struggles to kind of try to remedy this balance and to organize ourselves. There's not an easy answer. You know, there's not an easy way to get to the destination that we want to get to, which is a world where these, you know, where money doesn't buy political power. People, we outnumber, as you said in the beginning, we outnumber the rich, and what we have to do is organize ourselves and do the hard work of democracy.
Well, just in closing, what would your invocation be to our audience, Astra Taylor, of why they should get your brand new book, Just Out, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone?
Well, I would hope that people would get my book because we're all thinking about democracy. We're thinking about the fact democracy is in crisis. And I wrote my book in part to give a bigger perspective, to remind us that our problems didn't begin, you know, with the election, the presidential election of 2016, but rather many of them have been embedded in our political system since the beginning. And yet the book, I hope, is not hopeless, because against great odds, people have come together. We have democratized our society, our political structures. And so I, in the end, I make the case, you know, for democracy, not as something that is, you know, done by brilliant political leaders, right, the founding fathers, but rather done by all of us, and that we need to be midwives birthing democracy into being, constantly renewing it and striving for a better world. So I hope the book helps articulate, you know, why democracy is so frustrating, why it can be so difficult to enact, but also why it's worthwhile nonetheless.
Well, Astra Taylor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Astra Taylor, the author of The People's Platform, which is the winner of the American Book Award. She has made three documentaries, Zizek, Examined Life, and her latest documentary, What is Democracy? Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, N+1, and The Baffler, where she's a contributing editor. And her latest book, Just Out, is Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.